I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is David Payne, co-founder and president of 9/11 Day. The organization's September 11th National Day of Service and Remembrance meal pack event is coming to Las Vegas this year for the first time. David, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
So first of all, what is 9/11 Day?
Yeah, so 9/11 Day was created about 6 months after the September 11th, 2001 attacks by a group of us, including 9/11 family members, who wanted something good to come from the tragedy and the loss of their loved ones. And the idea was essentially to transform the anniversary of 9/11 itself into a National Day of Service. And so our nonprofit was created, and then we started walking the halls of Congress, and ultimately were successful in getting 9/11 designated as a day of service under federal law, which is what it is today.
Nice. Okay. So you took a negative event and turned it into something positive and lasting.
Yeah, I had a very good friend of mine, Jay Winnick, who lost his brother, Glenn, in the collapse of the World Trade Center South Tower. And Jay's brother, Glenn, was an attorney who worked at a law firm, Holland & Knight, just a few blocks from the World Trade Center area. But he was also a trained volunteer firefighter. And so when the towers were struck, Jay's brother, Glenn, went into New York. He evacuated his law office, and then he borrowed a medic kit from the New York Fire Department that was on the scene. And he went into the South Tower and was in the process of getting people out of there when the building suddenly came down upon him. And soon thereafter, Jay and I began talking about how we could find an appropriate way to honor his dead brother, Glenn, and the many other people that rose in service in response to the attacks and the victims of more than, nearly 3,000 people that were killed on that day. And we thought the best way to do it would be just to keep alive the spirit of unity and togetherness that we ourselves experienced right after 9/11, when, you know, this nation wasn't red states or blue states. We were just human beings and Americans wanting to help one another.
Yeah. Wow. What an amazing story. So tell us about what happens at the annual September 11th National Day of Service and Remembrance.
Well, you know, it's now been almost 24 years since we created the 9/11 Day observance, and it's grown to become the largest day of service in America. More than 30 million people get out and observe the day by doing simple good deeds. You know, they volunteer, or they make a donation to a charity, or they help a friend move. Children, you know, give away clothing that they've outgrown or work with their parents to come up with other things to do, like bake cookies for local fire and police stations. So it's this extraordinary day of doing good, which is really what we wanted it to be. And it's also a day of unity where, you know, we try to all remember how much we do have in common, despite, you know, whatever differences we might think we have politically or otherwise. And so it's become a very positive and I think appropriate observance that pays tribute to people who were, you know, killed on that day and the many first responders, members of our military and others that rose in service. In addition to that, all across the nation in 24 cities, our nonprofit also runs these large-scale hunger relief projects called meal packs. And we'll be launching our very first meal pack in Las Vegas this year for the first time. So we'll have 24 all around the nation. And in aggregate, well, the volunteers will pack close to 9 million meals in Las Vegas specifically. We expect to have close to 500 people that will be joining together at the Thomas & Mack Center on September 11th. And we anticipate that they'll assemble close to 150,000 meals that will be donated to the local Feeding America affiliated food bank.
Nice. Okay. So what are some of the other cities it's being held in this year?
Yeah, so the meal packs that we organize, and again, that's just the tip of the iceberg when you think of all the people that are doing good deeds all around the nation. And there are so many nonprofits and schools and faith groups participating. Above and beyond that, you know, we'll be in these 24 locations, Las Vegas being one, but we're also in Salt Lake and Los Angeles and in Chicago and Atlanta and Dallas and Houston and Columbus, Ohio, and Cleveland, and of course, Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C., and many other cities where in aggregate we'll have well over 30,000 Americans who will be joining together in unity to pack about 9 million meals for Americans who are at risk of hunger.
So, with this being the first time that the Meal Pack event is happening in Las Vegas, the other cities sound like, large cities that you've probably done it in before. So, why Las Vegas now?
Well, Las Vegas is really part of our broader plan to be in as many as 50 cities with these Meal Pack events by 2026, next year, which will be the 25th anniversary of 9/11. It's hard to believe that it'll be 25 years next year. And, we love Las Vegas. It's a great town. It's very community-minded. We've gotten tremendous support from the Thomas and Mack Arena, which is donating a lot of the space. We have casinos and other groups that have participated in promoting the day of service, and we just felt like it would be a great additional location to add to what will be ultimately 50 cities where we will be staging these large meal pack events next year for the 25th anniversary of 9/11.
Awesome. Okay. So you said that the food goes to the local Feeding America food bank, which here in Las Vegas is Three Square. So Three Square will be receiving this 150,000 meals.
Well, we're anticipating that, we'll have well over 500 volunteers that'll pack, close to 150,000 meals, if not more. And yes, all the meals will be donated directly to Three Square Food Bank for distribution to people in the community who benefit by food assistance. And a lot of people don't realize how profound the hunger problem is in America. It's really something that, neighbors right down the street, can be experiencing. And typically, one in four households that need food assistance also include a military veteran. And so, in aggregate, we've just felt that focusing on hunger relief would be particularly important. September is Hunger Action Month anyway. And so it gives us a chance not just to pay tribute on 9/11, but to shine a light on the importance of addressing hunger in almost every community around this country.
All right, so volunteers will be spending 9/11 packing food for Three Square, but where does all that food come from?
Well, what we do is we source all that food from American farmers. So in this particular case, this is going to be an oatmeal type of breakfast product with brown sugar. So it's a very healthy, beneficial, non-perishable meal. And what we do is we assemble that in food packets that typically feed a family of six for a pretty low price. And then we donate those food packets to Three Square Food Bank, which then, distributes them throughout the community as part of their regular distribution of food that goes to pantries and to other community-based organizations.
Okay. Now you mentioned it's happening at the Thomas and Mack Center at UNLV. What are the details of exactly the time that all of this is happening?
Well, it's currently scheduled to run from about 9 a.m. to 11. And in order for people to participate in the event, they would need to send us an email because most of the volunteer spots are already taken. But there may be some limited space available. And so anybody who's interested in potentially volunteering to participate at the Las Vegas Meal Pack should drop us an email at info@911day.org and we'll respond and let them know right away if there's space.
Okay, fantastic. And where can people find out more information about 9/11 Day, the organization, and everything that you do?
We always encourage people to go to our website, which is 911day.org, where you can learn a lot about the history of the organization. If you happen to be a teacher or a parent and want free lesson plans or other kind of educational materials to talk to young people about 9/11 in a non-threatening way, we have all these great program guides and other things that can help teachers and parents get their children involved in coming up with their own good deed for 9/11. So it's a terrific place to start. There's a lot of terrific resources, wonderful resources that are on our website. So I would certainly suggest going to 911day.org as your first stop to identify things that you can do and to learn a little bit more about our organization and our mission.
Fantastic. So once again, the website for 9/11 Day is simply 911day.org. That's the number 9, the number 1, the number 1, 911day.org. You can find out more about what the organization does across the country. And if you would like to request the opportunity to volunteer, at the 9/11 Day Meal Pack event, which is happening on 9/11 from 9 to 11 a.m. at the Thomas and Mack Center. Send an email, info@911day.org, and say that you would like to be a volunteer at the Las Vegas Meal Pack event this year. And if there is room, then you can be one of those 500 people packing food to help out Free Square. And we've been speaking today with David Payne, co-founder and president of 9/11 Day. And David, I really appreciate you being here. First of all, for sharing the amazing work that your organization is doing and has been doing for the past almost 24 years now. And also for bringing this amazing event to Las Vegas, where people can help out, give service on 9/11, and make a difference to the people in our community who need that help. So I really appreciate you sharing today. Thank you so much.
Heather, thank you so much.
Many of our U.S. veterans and service members face challenges: mental health struggles, housing obstacles, employment, food insecurity, and social isolation, to name just a few. I'm Bob Woodruff. My family and I started the Bob Woodruff Foundation in 2006 after I sustained a life-threatening injury while reporting from Iraq. Our service members had my back that day, and we need to have theirs now more than ever. At the Bob Woodruff Foundation, we raise awareness about the tough challenges veterans and military families face and invest in solutions to help support them in the next chapter of their lives. And with one solution comes the next. We solve a housing situation, we increase employment opportunities, we solve employment problems, we address food insecurity. We solve food insecurity, we impact physical and mental health issues. Learn more about our work at bobwoodruffoundation.org/success.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Samuel Rudd, President and CEO of the United Way of Southern Nevada. The organization's 10th annual Day of Caring is coming up. Samuel, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So pretty much everyone has heard of the United Way, but what exactly does the organization do?
United Way of Southern Nevada, our mission is to unite the community to improve people's lives. And we really do that in three primary ways. The first is to help students reach their potential. The second is to ensure that there are pathways into the workforce. And then the third is to help people avoid crisis and maintain household stability. We really do that by being a bridge that connects those who need help with people who can help. And when we do that together, we build a stronger community.
Nice. Okay. So what is the Day of Caring?
So the Day of Caring is an annual event where we gather, and this year, over 1,000 volunteers to come to really support the community across the valley. We gather initially at the Town Square Park and have a kickoff. And then we have over 40 projects that are going on across the valley to help local nonprofits, schools, and community organizations. And we all disseminate across the valley to do the work that's prepared for us. And these can include a variety of projects, including building wellness kits or cleaning books, enhancing school gardens, or even packing groceries for families in need. Variety of projects that people can register for. And the goal is to really ensure that people understand the value of volunteering and the need that our community has to ensure that we do this together.
Wow. Okay. That sounds great. Why is the Day of Caring important to the Southern Nevada community?
Well, first of all, this is our 10th annual Day of Caring. So we've been doing this for some time, and it's something that many people enjoy and see as a way to connect and learn about the different nonprofits that are serving our community and ensure that they get plugged into what they're passionate about. But I think it's also really important because currently Nevada is 46th in the nation when it comes to volunteering. And I think we have some room to grow. And I think that our community really desires to work together. And so if we can help enhance the understanding of what goes on in the community, how important it is to volunteer and support the community and be there for one another, really our focus is that united is the way that we change lives. And so when we come together and join forces, we can make a huge impact to ensure that the people who have that need have those needs met.
Nice. Okay. Now, you mentioned Town Square Park, but what are the details of where and when exactly it's happening?
Yes, so this is going to be Friday, September 19th, and at 8:30 a.m., the Town Square Park, we're going to have a kickoff celebration. We'll have a DJ and a delicious breakfast provided by Brio, and we'll have a pump-up session to get everybody excited to go out, and then we'll release everyone about 10 o'clock to go into the various locations all across the valley.
So you mentioned that you're expecting 1,000 volunteers. How many volunteers are you still looking for?
So actually, as of this morning, we have over 1,000 volunteers, which is our goal. We wanted to have at least 1,000, but there's still plenty of opportunity for more people to join. And that can be done by going to uwsn.org/caring. Again, uwsn.org/caring to sign up for the Day of Caring. There'll be a variety of different opportunities that'll be present that people can pick from, find their passion. You can do this as an individual, you can do this as a team, you can do this as a company, and just find a way to connect and help the community in greater ways. And also, what's great about this is that this is not meant to just be a one-day event, but rather finding organizations that you can connect with and help all year round.
Okay, so you mentioned that when they go out into the community, that part starts at 10 a.m., but how long does it go? Is this a full day thing?
It's a full day thing. And depending on what project you pick, some of the projects start later in the day, even in the evening. Some of the projects start right at 10 o'clock. It just depends on what project you pick, what area of town you're in. And so those instructions will be there when you sign up.
And how many service projects are included in total?
So currently we have about 40 service projects that are set, and those grow all the way up until right before the event. So, we've had between 40 and 60 projects in a given year.
Nice. Okay. What are some of the industries or verticals that people might be able to volunteer in? Like, can they work with kids, animals, vets?
Yeah, definitely with animals. We have a group that helps support kids with cleaning books. There are some restrictions as to, having the proper vetting ahead of time when you're working directly with kids. So for this particular event, there won't be a direct connection there, but there'll be projects that can help kids with other outreaches that happen. We also have school gardens that you can go in and enhance, and those are benefited by the kids. We also have ways to support the elderly and other demographics of people that need assistance.
Okay, so with this being the 10th annual Day of Caring, how has this day grown over the past decade?
Yeah, good question. So this has definitely grown. This is going to be our largest group of volunteers in the last 10 years. Every year it's gotten bigger and bigger. And there's a lot of people that see this as something that they love doing and come back year over year, but it grows every year, and it's just word of mouth spreading the opportunity to really make an impact in our community.
Nice. So you mentioned the website, but one more time, how do people find out more about the United Way of Southern Nevada 10th Annual Day of Caring, sign up to take part, or even find out about the United Way of Southern Nevada in general?
Yeah, so our general website is uwsn.org, and there's a variety of opportunities for you to see a calendar of events, ways to get involved, including ways to donate to causes that you are passionate about. But specifically for the Day of Caring, it's uwsn.org/caring. Again, uwsn.org/caring to give you all the details on the Day of Caring and the specific volunteer projects that you can sign up for.
All right, fantastic. So once again, the website for United Way of Southern Nevada is uwsn.org. And if you're interested in finding out more about the 10th annual Day of Caring, once again, that's happening on Friday, September 19th, kicking off at 8:30 a.m. at Town Square Park with the kickoff celebration. And you can find out all the details at uwsn.org/caring. uwsn.org/caring. And we've been speaking today with Samuel Rudd, President and CEO of the United Way of Southern Nevada. And Samuel, I really appreciate you being here and letting us know, first of all, more about what United Way of Southern Nevada does for the community, but specifically the 10th annual Day of Caring, the largest day of volunteerism. Sounds like a fantastic opportunity for people to get involved in helping out amazing causes. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
To the big-hearted, the bold, the teachers, the growers, the builders, the change makers, we need you. We are the Peace Corps. In more than 60 countries, we go the distance to make a difference. We're volunteers, partners, communities, bringing our experience, joy, and passion to building a better world together. Are you looking for more? Then we are looking for you. Join us at peacecorps.gov.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Shannon Miller, 7-time Olympic medalist, ovarian cancer survivor, and women's health advocate, along with Dr. David O'Malley, Division Director for Gynecologic Oncology at the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. September is Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month, and Shannon's here to share her story and help other women on their own health journeys. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
So, Shannon, people know you as an Olympian, but what's your experience and journey with ovarian cancer?
Well, my experience started in 2010 and was diagnosed with a rare form of ovarian cancer in early 2011. And I would say that fighting cancer is the hardest thing that I've ever had to do mentally, physically, emotionally. But I think you never really know how strong you are until you just have to be. And not a physical strength, but just that inner strength that helps you take that next forward step.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I mean, watching you do gymnastics, people would say that's hard and that takes resilience and that takes strength. But you're saying fighting cancer was harder than that.
Absolutely. I think anyone that's been diagnosed with cancer knows, and really the family that goes along with it as well, know that it is such a challenging fight in every sense. And that's why it's so important to create awareness and make sure that people know that they're not alone in the fight.
What prompted you to become an advocate for women's health?
I was an advocate for women's health generally, even before my diagnosis, but certainly being diagnosed with ovarian cancer allowed me to really focus and really wanted women to be able to ask the questions that I didn't ask going through my cancer diagnosis. I want them to ask about every tool in the toolkit, everything that's available for them. And that's why we're here in partnership with AdVie to talk about all of those tools, including biomarker testing, that can be utilized to unlock personalized care for specific types of ovarian cancer.
Okay. So Dr. O'Malley, what exactly is biomarker testing?
Well, Heather, biomarker testing can be in our genes. Those are through, that's what makes up our body. That's through our entire body, all our organs, but also can be on the tumor, on the cancer. The most common ones in ovarian cancer are BRCA 1 and 2, HRD, folate receptor alpha, as well as other like mismatch repair protein deficiencies, Lynch syndrome, things like that. And again, we can now test the tumor looking for unique patterns or biomarkers, markers, which allows us to target therapies directly to those markers or direct therapies which are able to take advantage of those abnormalities in the tumor so that we can kill the cancer cells. So important for us to identify those personalized approaches by biomarker testing.
Yeah, okay. And compared to other processes along the journey of fighting ovarian cancer, how important is biomarker testing in the scope of things?
Well, it's essential. You know, unfortunately, most patients are diagnosed with metastatic disease at the time of their diagnosis. And unfortunately, more than half still recur, as high as 70% still recur. So we need better therapies. We need to cure more patients. These biomarker testings will help. But if a patient recurs, it becomes even more important because we really need to target the right therapy for the right patient at the right time. In Nevada, about 200 patients a year will be diagnosed, but so many more are alive with the disease because patients live so much longer because of these new therapies. So if you are a patient with ovarian cancer or a family member with ovarian cancer, please make sure that you have your physician, your healthcare team, test for these biomarkers so you can identify hopefully more targeted therapies.
Okay. How prevalent is ovarian cancer?
Ovarian cancer overall is about 1 out of 100 women throughout their lifetime will be diagnosed with ovarian cancer. So it's not super common, but it's actually becoming more prevalent because women are living so much longer, even if they recur, that we have so many more women alive with ovarian cancer than it sounds like at the time of diagnosis. Just under 200 in Nevada per year, but many more alive battling ovarian cancer at this time.
Wow. Okay. Shannon, what would you say to women who are going through a recent diagnosis of ovarian cancer?
I just want women and those family members and loved ones around them to know that you're not alone in this fight. Find your team, ask questions, and know that there really is such strength in seeking support. And of course, if you do want more information about biomarkers, you can always go to biomarkerboost.com.
Great. And Shannon, how would you encourage women who like the idea of advocating for themselves, but they just don't know how?
I was one of them. And I think a diagnosis of cancer can help you find your voice in this strange way. And we have to be able to speak up and advocate for ourselves. It's what our physicians, it's what our care team wants from us. They want to know what's going on so that they can help.
Okay. And Dr. O'Malley, what would you like women to know about ovarian cancer for Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month?
Be aware of your symptoms, partner with your healthcare team, ask questions, making sure that we have the greatest opportunity to get the best therapies to our patients at the right time. So please ask questions, partner with your entire healthcare team. Don't forget the caregivers that are supporting out there. We really want you to be involved also.
Yeah, absolutely. And once again, that website is biomarkerboost.com if you'd like more information about biomarker testing for ovarian cancer. And we've been speaking today with Shannon Miller, 7-time Olympic medalist as a gymnast, ovarian cancer survivor, and women's health advocate, along with Dr. David O'Malley, gynecologic oncology at The Ohio State University. And I really appreciate you both being here. Dr. O'Malley, telling us more about ovarian cancer and biomarker testing. And Shannon, for sharing your story with us and how you have fought through it. So thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Heather, thank you so much for having us and talking about this important subject. We really appreciate the opportunity.
Cancer can feel like something we can't do anything about, but you can. There are screening tests that can catch cancer early when it may be easier to treat. Begin cervical screening at age 25. At 45, start colorectal and breast screening. At 50, discuss lung screening with a doctor. Find resources for free and low-cost screening at cancer.org/get-screened. This is a public service message from the American Cancer Society.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Robin Growley, Head of Consumer Deposits at Bank of America. As students settle into the academic year, many are also facing a crash course in personal finance. Robin, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, I appreciate you having me, Heather.
So, with the rising cost of living in general, what are your top tips for students specifically to save money on everyday expenses?
Yeah, you know, for our students who are just getting out there, many are building their, you know, financial journey just at the beginning of their financial journey. One of the things we like for them to really think about is starting out with a budget, right? Really being able to understand the inflows that they have coming in and what they're going to be spending on, especially for those that may be going off to college, living off campus for the first time. There are other expenses that maybe they haven't had to deal with before, right? So setting that budget and being able to manage appropriately will really help get them off to the right start and then ensure that they really don't add to the stress of being in college and school.
When you talk about setting a budget, a lot of people just mentally tune out. Can you give us, in a brief nutshell, what are the keys to doing a budget and doing it properly and doing it well?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think you're right. Some people, you know, tune out because they think, oh, it's so hard and it's so daunting. But really, when, you know, I talk to any of our clients about setting a budget, I think it's easy just to take a very simple approach. And I like to use what's called the 50-30-20 rule. And that's where you take 50% of your income to cover your needs. And that's things like your rent, your utilities, maybe if you, you know, you have a mortgage if you're a bit older. And then 30% should go to your wants. We all want to go do fun things, right? We want to go out to dinner to with friends. We want to buy that new shirt or, you know, if you're in college, who knows, the fancy sneakers, right? Those types of things. So 30% of your budget should go to the wants. And then the last 20%, that should be put towards our savings. And I really want to underscore that part because I think that's where sometimes we see folks say, oh, well, I really don't need to save. And savings becomes a really important part of your overall financial journey. And even if you put that 20% in and on, you know, this whole, it doesn't look like a lot, it's more important getting in that habit of saving. So use that 50-30-20 rule, really simple kind of rule of thumb to ensure that you set the budget. And then also once you set your budget and you look at your spending, always think about your budget as something you can go back to and adjust. So if you see that, you know, 1 month, maybe you have that unexpected expense that you have to pay, right, then you might need to cut back on your wants. You may not be going out as much that month. So the budget is something that should continue to be revisited, but keeping it very simple will help get you on the right track.
Okay, yeah, great advice. Now, what are the most important do's and don'ts for students and recent grads who are building credit for the first time?
Yeah, that's a really great topic. And you always get the question of, should we use credit? Should we not? And I always say credit is a financial tool that should be in our toolkit, but it needs to be used responsibly. And, you know, a couple do's and don'ts, I always like to say, you know, do pay off your purchases in full and on time each month. If you miss or you make a late payment, then that can lead to a late payment fee and ultimately hurt your credit score. And we know as, you know, someone just starting out on their financial journey that it would make it harder, you know, if you have an impact to your credit score, it's going to make it harder to obtain future credit. So if you want to buy your first car or you want to get a lease on an apartment, so the higher your credit score can be, the better off you're going to be longer term. Also, do keep your balance well under your credit card limit. So it's exciting sometimes when you get your first credit card and you see what your max limit is and you think, oh, I can spend up to that amount. Well, you know, don't do that. Make sure that you're really aiming to use only 30% of that max limit. And if you're really trying to say, you know, 30% or under of your max limit, that's going to help you boost your overall credit score as well. And then lastly, don't apply for multiple cards at once. And I know this can be really tempting, especially if you're out there shopping for your first credit card, you know, and depending on what you're looking for, there are multiple cards with cash back or rewards or travel. But don't apply for multiple credit cards at once. And because if you do, then that can temporarily lower your credit score as well. And in addition, it can make you and encourage you really to overspend, right? It's harder to control your spending. Sometimes you may not remember what you spent on each card, and then that can lead to debt and not being able to make your payments. So just being able to have one card, use it responsibly, and then as you get more comfortable managing that card responsibly, certainly you can, you know, adjust as needed going forward.
Yeah, great. Okay. Now, in the 50-30-20 rule, of course, the 20% was for savings. So how can students and new grads make the most of their income, which might be limited, to start actually building those savings and building an emergency fund?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's really important when we think about the emergency fund, understanding that you can start small, right? So especially maybe you're, you know, a high school student and you think, well, I don't have enough to save, or maybe it's that first college job. And even being able to start small and put, even if it's $20 away a month, and kind of dedicating that in a separate account. And I think that's the key here is sometimes we like to think, oh, just put everything into the checking account, but that leads to the temptation of spending whatever is in that account, right? And so if you have it in a separate account and you really first think about the funds that are sitting in that account as your funds for any type of emergency to pop up. So maybe you've got your car, you're commuting back and forth to college. If you have a car that, you know, breaks down, you might have that unexpected auto expense, right? So having that emergency fund would be really beneficial. And again, getting it started with a small amount each month can be the best way to put yourself in that position to care for any type of emergency that could come up.
Okay, great. What sorts of digital tools or apps do you recommend that students can use to simplify, automate, and keep their financial journey on track?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, think about just us, and certainly as we look at our students, we always have a phone, you know, in our hand typically, right? We're always using doing something digitally. And so I think using automatic savings tools is one of the best ways to really keep us within our budget and make sure that we're, you know, moving along our financial journey to meet our goals. And one of the ways to think about automatic savings tools is if you, you know, you're out there and you do have that first job, you're getting your paycheck now, making sure that you're taking your paycheck and you can have it automatically deposited in both a checking account and a savings account. So think about it as being able to pay yourself first, dividing that paycheck automatically. Portion of it can go into your checking account to cover the needs that I talked about, right? The rent, the utilities, but the other portion can go into a savings account. And that really is paying yourself first. You can set that amount that goes into the savings account. And that way it's really that more set it and forget it type mentality. You don't even have to think about doing it, right? It's one less thing on the to-do list. And then also look for other tools that are out there to help encourage savings. So at Bank of America, we have a program called our Keep the Change. That's where we automatically round up your debit card purchases to the nearest dollar, and then we transfer that change from your checking account to your savings account. So again, another great way to help you build your savings, to help you reach your savings goals without having to put something else on your to-do list.
Yeah, okay, great tips. Where can listeners go for more information about healthy financial habits?
Absolutely. Your listeners can visit bettermoneyhabits.com. They'll be able to find financial guidance and advice on many of the topics that we discussed today.
Okay, fantastic. Once again, that website is bettermoneyhabits.com, bettermoneyhabits.com, put out by the Bank of America, and you can find plenty of financial education tips and digital tools that you can use. And we've been speaking today with Robin Growley, Head of Consumer Deposits at Bank of America. And Robin, I really appreciate you being here with these fantastic tips for those young people who are starting out on their financial journey, how they can do it right the first time. So thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks again for having me, Heather.
Teachers are dynamic leaders, shaping a new generation. They bring a variety of perspectives from diverse backgrounds, innovating how they teach to prepare students for our fast-changing world. Achieving this takes skill and expertise. They're tireless explorers, creatively discovering a universe of solutions, telling stories, experimenting, inspiring, mentoring, connecting cultures, and connecting with each other. Leading by example. Experience the unique joy of helping students thrive. Teaching is a journey that shapes lives. Are you ready to begin? Explore teaching at teach.org, a campaign supported by the U.S. Department of Education, teach.org, and 1 million teachers of color.
I'm Dennis Foley. September is National Preparedness Month, and time for you and your loved ones to make sure you know what to do in a time of disaster, and making sure you have what you need during that said disaster. The American Red Cross's Stephanie Fox joins us on the show. Can you explain what National Preparedness Month entails?
National Preparedness Month is an opportunity for folks to kick off their preparedness practices or refresh them. It's just a month to really get an idea of what you and your family may need to do, what you may need supply-wise, how you'll get information in the event of an emergency, like a natural disaster, a home fire, things like that.
So with all these disasters, and of course we have listeners all across the country who may all experience a wide variety of different disasters in their lifetime, how do you approach each type of disaster differently? Or is there a way that you can just kind of consolidate everything to, hey, this is my disaster plan for anything that happens?
The best thing about a disaster plan is it really can apply to any type of disaster you could experience. The intricacies around what is included and what your family may need specifically, that's where it may differ person to person, family to family. But you should really start by taking assessment of your family makeup. Do you have pets? Do you have small children? Do you have folks that have medical conditions or may need electricity for medical devices? Do you have somebody who is elderly in your home? Take understanding and kind of gather what are those specific needs for each of those individuals in your family? And how would you meet those needs, whether you're going to be evacuating or staying at home, and maybe your connectivity to resources is going to be a little limited. Maybe power's off for a little bit of time. Perhaps, the grocery stores aren't open. Maybe the gas stations aren't open. So you'll really want to take assessment of exactly what those needs are that would need to be met. And for each of those different scenarios, you're going to create a kit. And that kit should include specific supplies like non-perishable food items, water, extra medication. For your stay-at-home kit, you'll want to again look at things that could sustain you for a little bit longer of a period of time than you would for instance, if you needed to evacuate to go stay at a shelter or an evacuation center or a hotel. So the difference between specific disasters really doesn't affect how you're building your kit. It's really what is going to be best for your family.
So for people and their own situations, how should people go about identifying their risks? Let's say you're in California versus Florida. Florida's probably see more hurricanes than California, but California may have wildfires or earthquakes. What should people do if they're not already aware of the risks that may exist around them? What should they consider? What is a risk? What's not a risk?
So there's a couple ways to go about it. First, I want folks to consider that because we are seeing an increase in extreme weather, we're seeing more frequent instances of extreme weather, and we're even seeing extreme weather happening in places that are not typically predisposed to that types of hazards. So I don't want folks to get too caught up on exactly what hazards are traditional and normal for their area because you never know what type of hazard may pop up. But you should always stay in the loop with your local office emergency management. They can really give you an idea of what traditional hazards may affect your community in particular. The National Weather Service as well. Paying attention to the watches and warnings and advisories and what they're talking about as threats and hazards to your community, specifically from a weather perspective, that can kind of give you an idea of what you're looking at and what hazards you may need to plan for. Also, with the Free Red Cross Emergency app, you can put in your zip code and it will actually show you some of the hazards that are traditional for your area and what you may need to plan for. So there's a few different ways to go about it to really get an understanding of what you may be at risk for. But again, I really want folks to not get too caught up on that hazard-specific language and to really ensure they're preparing for any kind of disaster that could happen.
So some areas may also experience non-natural disaster hazards. Let's say you live near a refinery or some other, I think of a situation in Ohio with the train derailment that had hazardous items on there. Sometimes you never know when those moments may happen. In a way, it's kind of like you have to kind of play with the crystal ball and be like, oh, anything can happen. I need to have everything. But, what do you do about risks that maybe aren't readily top of mind? Again, we think of weather, but other types of disasters happen too.
So that's where we definitely want to understand how our local county or parish is going to issue advisories or emergency alerts, right? If something happens to a refinery or with a train derailment or any of these no notice type events that may not be top of mind because they're not a traditional natural disaster, your local community government will have a plan for that, and they will have mechanisms in place, whether it be text messaging or an emergency alert across your television, your radio. Perhaps they will have sirens. I actually live just south of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I am not too far from several chemical plants. So I know every week on Monday at noon, they test the alarms, and that would be our notification if something were to happen in the community when we hear those alarms that, that triggers, oh, we need to turn on the TV. We need to pay attention to what's going on. We need to go on social media to check and see with our local Office of Emergency Management what actions we may need to take or what we may need to be aware of. But definitely checking in with your local Office of Emergency Management where you live to understand what are those no notice type alternate hazards that could happen in your community.
So when these disasters happen, a lot of times people face the internal question of, do I stay or do I go? Generally, what's the rule of thumb? If someone's in that position, I mean, if it's a massive hurricane that's going to be blasting through your city, you probably should go. But there may be situations where it's actually better to stay rather than go because of, you know, highway traffic or whatever the case may be. What are some factors that people should consider? Because some people might just plan on, hey, I'm just going to get in my car and go somewhere. Is that always the right move?
We really, really want to encourage folks that if their local emergency officials are telling them it's time to evacuate, it's time to evacuate. You really need to heed their direction because they're doing so for the safety of you and your family. If there is not an evacuation ordered for your area, but maybe you are reliant on electricity for medical needs, then you may want to consider where you would go. That could be a hotel or a friend's home in the next city over, or an emergency shelter with the local Office of Emergency Management or the American Red Cross or anybody in your community who sets up those shelters. But it really comes down to understanding what your personal needs may be, but absolutely following and heeding the direction from your local Office of Emergency Management and your emergency officials should they be ordered.
So the American Red Cross is usually involved in disaster responses when they do happen. Do you guys do any sort of preparation yourselves during National Preparedness Month? How does the Red Cross prepare to help those that are preparing?
We are preparing year round. We are in a state of nearly constant response these days, from wildfires to flooding to hurricanes. Even the most recent Hurricane Erin, while she didn't directly impact the U.S., she caused a lot of issues with rip currents and caused issues across the Outer Banks with some coastal flooding. So we are constantly responding and constantly ensuring that we have the mechanisms in place to respond whenever and wherever a disaster may strike, and whatever that magnitude of disaster it may be. So this month in particular, we are in the midst of hurricane season. We are almost at the peak of hurricane season. And while things have been pretty calm so far, we know that can change in an instant. We're also in the midst of wildfire season. So we are training up our volunteers across the country to ensure we have a steady, strong workforce to respond to the needs of a community, wherever that may be. We are taking stock of our supplies and our warehouses across the country to ensure that they are staged in the right places for the right time. We are doing a lot of outreach in the communities as well this month to really talk about what is National Preparedness Month. What are things people can do? How should they go about developing their plans, building their emergency preparedness kits? What conversations should they be having with their community, with their loved ones? So we are really doing the exact same thing that we are encouraging folks to do, and that is taking stock, that is being prepared, and that is putting the mechanisms in place for us to be able to respond to a community in need.
And a lot of what the Red Cross does is, you know, jumping into these disaster situations. I would imagine when people are more prepared for emergencies, it makes your guys' job a bit easier. Is that a fair assessment?
A prepared community is one that's going to be more resilient in the aftermath of a disaster. If you have things in place and you understand what you'll need to do to keep your family safe, what is going to work best for planning purposes, you're going to be a bit calmer in the situation. It's not going to be quite as much of a rush and a panic to do what needs to get done. And having those planning assumptions prepared and ready mean that recovering is also going to be a little bit easier. No disaster is going to be a cakewalk. It's always going to be scary and traumatic and difficult to navigate. But the more you can do on the front end, the better prepared you're going to be to start those slow steps of recovery and to understand where you may need additional assistance, where the Red Cross can step in, not just in the immediacy, but in the long term of your recovery processes, and what's going to be available in your community. A lot of communities have incredible organizations that are there all the time, not just that step up in the midst of disasters. So being aware allows folks to really react in the right way in the moment and then navigate the recovery in a way that's a little less hectic.
So again, this is National Preparedness Month. What are some resources that the Red Cross has that can help people prepare this month and in general?
The Red Cross Emergency app is a great resource. It is free. It not only provides tips and tricks as far as how to be prepared, what different hazards you may have in your community, it also provides push notifications based off of your zip code. And those are fed in directly from the National Weather Service. So any watches and warnings that get issued, those will pop up directly on your phone. And you can get that critical information to you in a really, really quick manner. It also allows you to set up alerts for loved ones. So if you find your loved one's zip code of their area, you can get alerted to hazards that may be in their area at different times. So you can ensure that if your mother's in an area that, you know, maybe she doesn't always watch the weather, maybe she doesn't have a smartphone or she's not completely connected all the time, you can set up an alert so you can call and say, hey, did you see this weather that's moving into your county? Did you see that there's a risk for some rainfall coming in? And what can I do to help? Redcross.org is also a really, really good resource. We have pages and pages of information on different hazards, what to do before, during, and after those hazards, how to prepare, again, those tips and tricks on how to build your emergency preparedness kit and what things you should think of. And of course, we want you to stay in touch with your local community, ensure you know how to receive warnings and where those will come from. And not just the Red Cross, but ensuring you know where additional warnings may be. You should be able to get alerts from at least two different places.
Awesome. Now, before I let you go, what would be your number one thing to have in your emergency kit or plan?
We live in a day and age where not a lot of folks carry cash with them. We use our phones, we use our debit cards, but we don't carry cash. But if there is a disconnection from Wi-Fi, or if the power's out, cash may be the only way for you to go out and purchase things if you need to go out and about to do that.
Steffi Fox of the American Red Cross, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Damage from wildfires is devastating and traumatic. After wildfires, dishonest contractors show up hoping to make a quick buck from your insurance claim. They'll promise anything if they can get you to sign a contract, collect your payment in advance, and ultimately do no work at all. Avoid being the victim of contractor fraud. Get estimates from at least three contractors. Check references, and remember, if you didn't request it, reject it.
To report fraud, call us at 1-800-TELL-NICB. This is a public service message from the National Insurance Crime Bureau.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Rebuilding Together Southern Nevada is holding their 6th annual Swing for Safe Homes Charity Golf Tournament this Monday, September 8th, with 7 a.m. registration and an 8 a.m. shotgun start at Reflection Bay Golf Club, Lake Las Vegas. Find out more or sign up to play at rtsnv.org. That stands for Rebuilding Together Southern Nevada, rtsnv.org. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, September 8th at 8 p.m. benefiting Conquer Paralysis Now, and Monday, September 22nd at 8 p.m. benefiting Kinsella Angels. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Collaboration Center Foundation is hosting their first Collab Cella Music Festival next Saturday, September 13th from 4 to 9 p.m. at the Collaboration Center campus, 8390 West Windmill Lane. Get your tickets or find out more at collablv.org. That's collablv.org. United Way of Southern Nevada is holding their 10th annual Day of Caring, their largest day of volunteerism, on Friday, September 19th, with kickoff celebration at 8:30 a.m. at Town Square Park. Find out more, see the available projects, or sign up to volunteer at uwsn.org/caring. That stands for United Way Southern Nevada, uwsn.org/caring. Shoes for Scholars is hosting their Smarts and Strides 5K Run and Walk on Saturday, September 20th, with registration at 7 a.m. and run and walk at 8 a.m. at Town Square. Find out more or sign up at shoesforscholars.org. That's shoesforscholars.org. Aid for AIDS of Nevada, or AFAN, is holding their 39th annual Black and White Party with a Wild West theme on Saturday, September 20th, starting at 9 p.m. at the Chaos Nightclub inside Palms Casino Resort, with VIP cocktail hour starting at 8 p.m. This annual fundraiser features a black and white dress code that encourages you to wear as much black and white as possible, or as little as you can get away with. Proceeds provide support and advocacy for adults and children living with and affected by HIV/AIDS in Southern Nevada. Get your tickets or find out more at afanlv.org. That stands for Aid for AIDS Nevada, Las Vegas, afanlv.org. And the All Life Pregnancy Clinic is holding their 40th annual Race for Life 5K Run and 1 Mile Walk on Saturday, October 11th from 7:30 to 10 a.m. at Cornerstone Park, 1600 Wigwam Parkway in Henderson. Get all the details and sign up to race or walk at alllife.org. That's A-L-L-Y-F-E, alllife.org.